I have a couple of themes left over, if I might kick off with one or another, and then we could pick them up from there and find out if this is what does interest you. There are a couple of real juicy ones thrown me yesterday, but I believe they're a little more down the line of what I've been doing. For example, the question of can you overanalyze and paralyze? I call it the paralysis of analysis. Being an historian, for example, I can easily cop out of the issues of the time by just talking about what did happen. I don't like to do that. My heroes are people like Dr. Bainton who know their history. You can ask him and you can just be very assured. He isn't going to mislead you. He isn't going to tell you unless he's quite sure, etc. That's the kind of people that are my heroes. But he doesn't let it there. He then does things with it. And this is something that was quite a risk in the historical profession. You were supposed to be an analyst and let everything end there. I recall when I entered the profession, reading an article about the premium in history at that time was to be totally accurate and totally dull. Know so much about your part of the topic that nobody could challenge you, but never have it mean anything. And the classic illustration they gave of this was a doctoral dissertation done at the University of Wisconsin on the development of the dairy industry in central Wisconsin, 1875 to 1878. And the professor fired the thesis back to the student and says, "You've covered this subject tit by tit." But to me, this is the kind of picture of paralysis of analysis. And so while some books I do or studies I do have to be content just to tell an old story, just as Bainton's Erasmus doesn't tell you everything's happening in the 20th century, yet I do think that, we were saying on the lawn the other day, we ought to be vulnerable to each other if we want to teach or learn. And so toward the end of each book, you try to stick in a few clues as to where we might go from here. And that's, of course, the part of the book that you are vulnerable on, and everybody can get you, but I think that that's where we might move the race forward a little. But that's about all I had to say on overanalyzing. I thought I would rather kick off the last hour here, something I haven't done an awful lot of this week, ask a little bit of some of the specifically Christian theological implications of what my own talks here were about, because I concentrated really on only two aspects of doctrine, and those only accidentally, and they were, what is man? And I think what I was saying is that man is neither by nature godless. He seems to flee from the jaws of one power to another. I think we often act as if you let man alone, he would be godless. Luther and Calvin don't think so. Luther sees the human mind as a constant idol-producing factory, I-D-O-L. That to which you cling to is your God, and everybody clings to. So I don't see him as simply godless, and on the other hand, I don't think that he, just left to himself, would ever invent something like the Christian faith, which we regard as revealed. And so I talked a little bit about these two extremes in man. What about modern man makes him look godless? We use the word secular. And what in man makes him look so religious? We talked a lot about another doctrine, though we didn't often bring up Bible verses to support it, and that was the character of community, how we are members one of another. We've implicitly talked about body of Christ often this week. We didn't talk about doctrine of God or Jesus or anything like this, and this has come up in a lot of our private conversations. One day somebody, I don't see him here this morning, said in this kind of vision, what happens to Jesus 2 years from now or 20 years from now? And I said, well, as long as you want to play that game, let's say 2 million years from now. That is, I was implying that it's possible in a time of great cultural upheaval that people reject a lot of their history. They find great difficulty carrying things along with them. And could it be, this man was saying, with all the risk you want us to take in the world, could it be that someday, he didn't use the picture, but I would draw it from there, Jesus would be like Zeus, Akhenaten, you know, one of the dead gods of the past. Here, I think the Christian has to give a twofold kind of answer. The second last thing I'll say to kick off. You have to give a twofold kind of answer. Jesus himself says two things about the future of faith. One in the form of a promise and one in the form of a question. And I think our life is lived between the two. On the one hand, he says the gates of death will not prevail against the church. heaven and earth will pass away, but his word will not pass away. So there is always the one side of what Bainton kicked us off with last Sunday night, the permanence, the reliability, which is other than what our text this week called worldly permanence and reliability. Worlds pass away, word doesn't. So on the one hand, you constantly have this kind of thing, the promise that no matter what happens, God will be ahead of you. And we know no way of talking about God except as he has revealed himself to us in Christ. On the other hand, I think we can make much too much of that passage and that promise and translate it into present social forms, so that when he says the gates of death will not prevail against the church, I think a lot of us sit back in our fannies and think that the church as we now know it, particular sociological forms and so on, are going to make it no matter how and what, and should make it no matter how and what. Here's where I think a historian does have a little gift to give. My own particular area of concern is to suggest to people that almost all forms that we're now fighting for in the church, and almost all forms that we're nervous about today in the church, and almost all forms that people imply when they say the good old days of Christianity, and almost all the forms that we think the faith can't get along without, were invented in the 19th century. We got along without them for 18 centuries. They were fashioned in the late 18th century from around the 1740s, the Wesleyan era, down to about the 1840s, the last pre-industrial moment. And so the models and the forms we have are all devised in the last era of villages, the last time before there were factories, labor unions, management, modern business, just before there were railroads, telephones, telegraphs, and so on. This was a very fertile Christian period. I like to argue that it was the most form-building, creative period since the Reformation. And I have no negative views of that era. I teach it, I love it. But right after these forms got put together, the world changed. Science got hooked on to industry and we got technology, a word invented in 1829. And invented then because it was needed then. The Sunday school as we have it was a wonderfully creative invention in England and in America to occupy kids all day with the sacred and the secular, to give them a little bit of literacy, because nowhere else all week would anybody bother to show them a printed page. Before long, the sacred and the secular got chopped apart, and the sacred was 5 days a week, and the secular was 1 hour of Sunday. We've never been able to move on from that form. The denomination was a wonderfully creative thing, as I said, to keep us from killing each other. It was a way of letting us hold to our truth as we saw it, and yet be tolerant of our neighbor. It was a response to disestablishment of the church, made it possible for us to voluntarily support. It has had great creative ventures, but it was most productive in the era before modern communication, so that you could get to a little island in Sumatra and find that 8 miles apart there would be a Southern Baptist church and a Norwegian Lutheran church and a Halle Mission church and an American Methodist church, and it didn't even look funny to people to have all these things on one little island because they didn't know a village 8 miles away. The scandal of division became most intense in the era of communication when you did begin to move from place to place, become aware of each other. So the denomination wasn't a bad invention, but it hasn't had a good explanation or rationale for over 100 years. The missionary enterprise was, as we know it, was invented in the 1790s through the 1830s. Most of the assumptions we have about the world, about how we relate to it, the cultural assumptions have greatly changed. And I think most missionaries, including a lot of them who come here, have much different views of how they go about their business than the people who are putting their $2.71 a year into the enterprise think they're doing. And so we've never quite been able to move into a new stage of involving the whole church in mission. Not so much for most Lutherans, but for many American Protestants, the forms of revival were invented in that era. One after another, you could see all these forms invented, and then things changed. Now, you might say ladies' aids, women's societies, auxiliaries, almost anything that is part of our ongoing program now dates to that period. I always think it's kind of therapeutic to draw a line 19 inches long on the board and say, these are the years of Christian history, to say nothing of how God dealt with his people before that, and then draw a little bracket around a half of those centuries and say, this is the thing that's now in trouble. Let's look elsewhere for some other models. So I want to imply this, that these cultural forms can pass greatly, and often have in the past, and by themselves don't touch what we're talking about. So that leaves the last thing I want to say, and then I'll turn over to Carol and to all of you. What might be implied when I said these cultural forms reach into every way we think about reality? Those of you who were here all the way back to last Monday, when we defined a worldview, a mentally furnished apartment. What does this do to, let's say, the doctrine of God? And here again, I think perhaps the historian's point of view might be helpful to people, because we often do confuse a necessary, useful formulation about God with witness to God. Remember the day I told the story of the church historian Harnack, who said the lady who swept up his room was a better Christian than he, and how I didn't want to believe it, but then I ended up believing it. In a sense, she was pointing to what Bainton was speaking of as the permanent and the durable. She could pierce through the complex to the simple, whereas he had to go through a much more difficult route. So if I ever talk about the simple gospel, it's not because I believe it starts being simple, but that the goal is to find its simplicity. Life is complex. We've got 92 trillion cells in our part of the brain that does its remembering and thinking. And 92 billion to the 92 billionth power of combinations to have ideas and memories, times 900 million people called Christian, it's just possible that it could be kind of complicated to make all these connections and relate them to the gospel. So when I say simple gospel, I have to be in the mood of Paul about the wisdom and the riches and the depth of God and say, how do I pierce through this complexity to get to the simplicity? So in every age, we have to take something of the thought forms of our own time. Now, what's in trouble? When I say it's just possible that men of the future may be able to receive this witness to God and conceive of God in ways equally appropriate for their time as these other forms were for their fathers, am I attacking God? I think God can take care of his own affairs. It isn't going to really be too troubled by what I'm saying. But what was I really getting at? I was getting at the fact that most of the ways we have of thinking about God are conditioned by the mentally furnished apartments our forefathers lived in. I'll give just a couple of samples. Next Trinity Sunday, if your church does what ours does, and reads the Athanasian Creed, pay very close attention as you read it. And then remember, this is Christian Orthodoxy. And then ask yourself, what would happen if somebody would come up and say, now explain it to me? I don't know. I study theology as many years as anybody does, and I'm neither smarter nor dumber than the other guys I graduated with, and I don't know any of them who could explain it, and I couldn't explain it, and I dare your pastor to explain it, or you. The Father uncreate, the Son uncreate, the Spirit uncreate. Think about that for a little while. What is it to be uncreate? I think people once upon a time did know that, and I think that to which it points is a very useful thing. But what am I getting at? Now, back up. Find that in the Bible. Find the Athanasian Creed's assertions clearly stated anywhere in the Bible. What do we have? Christians who had come out of the Hebraic worldview, and I think we're much closer to them than we are to what followed, spoke without any such terms. They don't have being and essence and substance and accident and all the things. What did they have? They had taste and see that the Lord is good. Yeah. Think what Lindy would do with that one. The Psalms, they're not abstract. They're all concrete. They're shepherds and hills and streams and hearts panting and so on. The Hebrew mind, I don't want to overdo the distinctions of kinds of mind, but the Hebrew mind, as we look back on it, is given to that. Jesus never took people aside for a dogmatic parable. He never expounded point 1, 2, 3, 3B. I always need 3B at least. Or Jonathan Edwards, the great American theologian in the colonial era. Now in the 19th place, he would say in his sermon, and everybody could take their notes that way. No, it's all jumbled together. I've always argued that the Gospels are very McLuhan-ish. McLuhan says we don't learn just sequentially. They're memory impressions. The church later on knows this is what he said, and this is what he said, and straightway they went there, and then he said, and then they came to him, and then they caught him, and then we get a kind of a coherent picture. You can't write his biography, but you get a coherent picture. Now, that's the mind in which it's fashioned. By the time the New Testament is written, though, it's beginning to have an encounter with a different kind of mind, so that you get toward Colossians that he was working with a little earlier this week, and you come to things, in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. Now you're starting to get over into people who are looking at reality in a much different way. Has God died? No, but they're certainly in a different mentally furnished apartment. Now, 3 centuries later, the church is facing the thought of its greatest enemy, the Greeks. Greek thought, of the kind Christians had to use, was to them as alien as Darwin, Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud is to us by nature. And they took all of its lingo, and they worked around with it, and they fashioned it, and they gave us our creeds. Nicene Creed, Athanasian Creed, the Council of Chalcedon, all of these. And Christian Orthodoxy is born of that. None of those things could have been written 4 centuries earlier. And if you're a historian, you'd start getting a view of all of the accidents that go into the way they're formulated. A couple of years ago, Albert Outler, the president of the American Society of Church History's presidential address was called Theodosius Horse. Now, why talk about Theodosius' horse? Well, he was playing the game of history. Remember Voltaire once said that if Cleopatra's nose had been an inch shorter or inch longer, history would have all been different. Okay, he did this with Theodosius' horse. The Emperor Theodosius is on the way to the Council of Chalcedon to help formulate a doctrine of Christ, and his horse rears up, and he's killed on the way, and the other party wins. Well, in other words, God could have survived Chalcedon if Theodosius had made it, and so on. I'm not going into the detail of all these things, but the accident of personality in these formulations. Last night we were talking about documents of Lutheran unity in America. Many of you are Lutherans. We're talking about how Lutherans might get together in the future, and I said they aren't going to get together on the basis of those documents. I read that whole book. I think I'm the only human that has, aside from Dick Wolf, who edited it. I had to because I was reviewing it. And I read it all, and I walked away from it saying there isn't a memorable line in it. I can only quote one or two lines from it. Lutheran altars for Lutherans only, and Lutheran pulpits for Lutherans only, something as the Galesburg rule. That's memorable, I guess. All right, they got one memorable line. But it doesn't sing, it doesn't zip, you can't put it on your guitar, you can't die for it or something. What is it? It's a calculation of 3 committees that sit down together. And I can see, oh, this sounds like Professor Madsen, who knew that across the room was Dr. Fent, who'd studied somewhere else, and in order to make this document acceptable to the ALC, or ELC, or someone, they had to be careful not to offend someone under whom Dr. Fent had studied. And then they had to remember that across the room were the Missourians, and they'd studied under somebody else. And you asked, how far can we push them today? And God was always down the middle. Wherever God is in life, I don't think he's in the middle. But documents of this kind are always so. Okay, that's how these things get written. They're not untrue, they're just unuseful. People who claim to live and die by them don't read them. So that's how these things get formulated, and God is not in trouble if the form gets going. I happen to be a very intense partisan of Chalcedonian Christology. I got to be that very accidentally. When I was in seminary, we invented a theologian because we didn't think those who'd been around had said the things we wanted them to say. We invented a man named Franz Bibfeld, who always came up with the quotation we wanted. And we had a Bibfeld society, which still goes on, by the way. And we would read learned papers to each other. And these were serious. The Bibfeld was put on, but the society wasn't. And we discovered it was 1951. It was the 1500th anniversary of the Council of Chalcedon. And we couldn't find anybody else that was going to celebrate it, so the Bibfeld Society did. All of us. My paper was on the concept of substance at the Council of Chalcedon. We did this, though, as put on, as I say, thinking how else could we have chosen a more irrelevant subject? Nobody else talked about it. A year later, at Lund, Sweden, Faith and Order of the World Council of Churches said, "We're having a terrible time helping the church express the full humanity of Jesus. Where could we turn to get some clues as to how this might be done?" Council of Chalcedon. And so for about 10 years, they studied how the Council of Chalcedon wrestled with the fact that Jesus is fully human and fully divine. And suddenly, eight of us had a whole head start. And we were suddenly relevant to everything. That's how I got started in all this stuff. Oh, and I happen to think that it's a beautiful formulation, and it's a perfect balance, and it's a tension we have to work on. But I wouldn't pretend to be able to say that my mind can grasp the concept of substance as they grasp it. All right, let's take another one. Seven centuries later, just as the Greek thought of Plato and his crowd had given the church a problem and then they took it over, seven centuries later, you had the thought of a pantheist named Aristotle being brought to the Western world from the hated Islamic Muslim part of the world up into Spain. So you have your main enemy, you're fighting wars against him, carrying the thought pattern of a man whose thought was believed to be antithetical to Christianity, and Christians faced it, and people start living in that mentally furnished apartment, and Christians start fashioning words with it, and they come up with the formulations of Albertus Magnus and St. Thomas Aquinas, and the official Catholic theology from then down to Vatican II, and of half of Catholic Church after Vatican II. Now, what happens? Again, was it false? I don't think it was false. In fact, I think it was true. And useful. And appropriate witness. It was, again, ministering to people the way they then thought. People then were able to separate things like the substance and the accident. Do you? I can't. I mean, I know what they were after, but I can't think that way. I kick this stone. It's substance. It's not that there's an appearance called a stone and then there's stoneness behind it, but they could. What came of this? Formulations of the Lord's Supper. Transubstantiation, which I think a lot of Lutherans still believe, and I know they were very nervous because a couple kids took some bread the other night, and I think way back we were Catholics transubstantiating that bread. All right. I was at a conference of Catholic theologians recently, and all around the room they start talking about it. And they kept saying, if we want to be faithful to the Bible, why don't we admit that you can't pull off transubstantiation today? You could, if you want to teach transubstantiation today, you're going to be superstitious. It wasn't when they formulated it, but it is now. And a debate came out, now should we keep teaching it to the people that way and keeping their security but having them be idolaters? Or shall we change it and rob them of their security and let them think maybe the church was wrong? Or be sophisticated enough to teach them that this was a true formula, but it was only a formula, and move on to what is present now? To me, all right, now the Lutherans, I think, did a lot of good revising of that, but our piety very often still lapses back into the substance and accident thing. And I've been at pastors' conference where people debate whether it turns into the body of Christ when he does this, and what if he forgets the sign of the cross, or when he puts it on your lip, does it become that? What about digestion? I mean, you get into all these debates. Oh, picture that supper, and picture Jesus getting involved in a debate as to when it turned into something else. It couldn't be. It just couldn't be the Hebrew mind. They could not have thought of it. Biblical scholars like to point out to us that the big debated word, "This is my body," "is" doesn't even exist in Aramaic. Jesus would kind of grunt, you know, "this, my body." Even the word that they fought about wasn't there. When they fought about it, they were fighting about a very good thing. And Dr. Bainkin can tell you more about this than I. But he can say what they were debating about is, where is Christ? Is he all over? Is he up in heaven? Is he among us? Is he resurrected? Is he an idea? Is it something we bring to the sacrament? I think those were terribly urgent and earnest debates. But I don't think we can move back into the world in which they were present. So I grab at a different text in the Bible. The bread which we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? The blood, the cup which we drink, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? there you got a biblical idea that modern people can wrestle with. What does communion do? It gives him to you here and now, really present, and it gives you to him. You're heavily committed. And if you want close communion, it's not because you have the batch of people who've thought out the doctrine exactly the right way. Try it in your parish some days. People who are all confirmed together. And write yourself a little simple quiz on what goes on in the Lord's Supper, and you'll get about 480 different views. What you're doing in close communion is asking people who have made a common commitment to him and have received this gift together and are responsible to each other. So the formula again is in trouble. Now, Protestants came in on the tail end of that language's vital moment. Alfred North Whitehead once said that the Protestant Reformation was a domestic quarrel of Northwest European peoples. Even the eastern half of the church didn't pay any attention to either side. We were both fighting on the same turf over the same language, used the same terms. It was the last possible moment people could have done it. The new scientific worldview was coming up. Excitement was moving elsewhere. But what happened? For that century, we took the last chance to put it in that thought world, which is what I called the other evening the Asian words. Reconciliation, justification, expiation. Shall we ask ourselves for definition of it? Propitiation. He is a propitiation for our sins. Are they untrue? No. They're simply, well, one or two of them survive. Reconciliation, I think, is a very live one. People reconcile their bank accounts or get reconciled in face of divorce. There are some of these that come through, and others might again. See, I'm a historian, and therefore I live in a very cluttered, junk shoppy kind of... Inside, I look a lot like the welding shop. I can't throw anything away. You never know which bolt you're going to need next. Chalcedon suddenly became relevant, so I don't let anybody throw anything away. And the job of the Baintons and the Treadways and the Martys and others are to keep those things around because the church is going to need them here and there. But they're not going to need them the same way. All right, so we got all of that the last round. Now, for four centuries, somebody's been knocking on our door just the way the Greeks did, and we got our orthodoxy, and just the way the scholastics did, and Catholics got their orthodoxy, and we got ours. Somebody's been knocking on the door. Some of the words I put up there, pragmatic, empirical, utilitarian, etc., etc. And we keep turning away. And I think that what's beautiful and exciting and risky about what's going on in the church today is that we're saying at last, we're not going to run away from those words any longer. People around us now are pragmatic. What's so bad about pragmatic? I remember a few years ago, Time Magazine wrote an article about our divinity school. And I said, well, one thing I liked about Chicago and its tradition was that we weren't afraid of words like pragmatic. I got a letter from a missionary in Hong Kong saying, I knew you as a little boy, and I'm so sorry you left the faith. Pragmatic meant to her John Dewey and William James, and that was it. The question is, what are you going to do with pragmatic? All right. We're taking the pragmatic, the empirical, the tasting, the touching. My hunch is we're going to be not better than our fathers of the 12th century or of the 4th century, but we will come up with things as appropriate. I gave the illustration the other day. Is conceiving of God as a petty oriental potentate necessarily the best way to do so? And yet an awful lot of the language of our piety does that. Maybe God made us upright because he liked to look us in the eye now and then. He'll get us flat on our back often enough, and we'll want to grovel sometimes, but is there any reason we should take a batch of people who want to celebrate, like communion, and say, you better kneel? It's the only banquet I ever go to that you kneel at, right? So Luther says, make it like the upper room. Well, I've gone on long enough to say that what I'm getting at throughout is one thing a historian kind of keeps doing all the time is this. I don't think it's the task of the whole church to be conscious of everything that ever happened in it. A professional historian wouldn't try. He carved out his own little niche. But society doesn't have a memory the way the individual does. You're not going to... my little boy isn't going to go in that sauna pool the way he did last night because he has a memory of what he did last night. He was too faint from being in there and he had trouble holding the rope. He's going to wait till he gets stronger. He's going to be more sure of himself. All right, you have a memory. The race doesn't have that. It is only transmitted. by people with words. And a historian is the guy who kind of keeps the record. When do you use it? When you stop to think. You consult the roadmap when you have to stop to think and you're not sure which fork to take. And this is what the historian is doing. He's keeping it around. He has all kinds of tools in his cluttered junk shop that we might use. But you're not going to use them for a different purpose. The bolt that they used to use for one thing in the mine might someday decorate, think of all the god-awful and pretty buffets around the country of people who've been up at Holden the summer before with little bits of a mine there. We got one too. It's pretty. And that's what we're doing in the church constantly. Now, is God touched by that? Is your doctrine of God one, or your picture of God one, in which he is threatened by this? Now, that's where I try to leave it. I don't. Is this something we should talk about?
Yeah, I think it's excellent, really. I mean, lots of the problems in our Lutheran church are because we don't even know the last century, not much less the first or the third, but just to know the last century. And this, Marty's pointed out, what happened then? He's got one side of it, and our seminaries ought to learn another, which most of them haven't. You've got one side, all of you, that you've been bought, for instance, 100% on your brainwashing. Communism is atheistic, as you've just simply said, you know, with your mother's milk practically in our society. But Marx got converted to Feuerbach before he ever got a notion of communism, and the two are quite easy to separate, and a lot of our Eastern Christians are able to do so. So, I mean, we've got a 19th century that's shaping us unconsciously all the time, and things don't have to be the same. One thing that gripes me in this situation, for example, is that people who finally get enough guts and creativity to dare maybe borrowing their insurance to take their family this far still think of Europe as being thousands of miles away. And so you'll feed your kids all that stuff that'll destroy their teeth and their health instead of telling them, we had a little round the world bank. And every time they'd ask for an ice cream cone or something like that that I didn't think was too good, I said, we're going to put in the round the world bank and spend it when we go around the world. You don't know, well, the kids sort of thought once in a while I might be putting them on. But the day came and we had 18 months in Europe and we bought a secondhand bus. We didn't stay in a hotel once. We really stayed in a campground. You know, they put in new curves in Europe and you can sleep on the old curve, perfectly safe and fun. And they learned three languages and had a great time. We went just when the youngest was just going to be two the next day, so we could get them over for $10 still. And before the oldest one got into college, you know, that's a good time to go. And we just made it in the bracket of our family with the six. And, of course, they always tracked others to them, so we never had less than about 12 in the Volkswagen going at a time, some of whom have come back to help shape the village, incidentally. But this kind of a thing that you owe your families in our kind of world to capture them with what television is capturing them with and what all these other excitements are, drawing them together into it. I've promised them, they'll never come here, that I won't use them for illustrations up here, but I couldn't help but use one the other day to Arndt, because they're just being about this whole crazy world in which our kids have information way beyond their experience. You know, before they're 12, they've been through everything that I never knew about when I was 24. And you could no more keep it from them than you could burn down your house. That's what you'd have to do, and live up in the woods someplace where they had nothing. But my wife and I were arguing about who's going to pick up a niece of mine who's living with us right then at the airport, and I thought I should because she was tired. She thought I should because I'd had a long day. And my youngest was sitting in the back seat, and he says, you oughtn't argue like that in front of me. I ain't that good of a boy. Well, that's today's family life, isn't it? You know, and he picked this up from TV in a dozen different ways, of course. But we have to find ourselves adapting to this kind of society. And Europe belongs to you. They ought to know their roots. You ought to get over there and see some of these towns where the old people came from. They ought to learn. We went into Augsburg, we went, Lord, keep us steadfast in thy word. And that's the one we memorized as we were going into Augsburg. And what a time we had singing it. And then we couldn't find a place at the Reformation.
You know what?
Forgotten them in Augsburg.
I visited Augsburg. My seminary roommate died, and I went to visit his widow, who was singing with the Munich Opera Company. And she piled me into her little VW. And we got in that Autobahn. You know, go to Europe, if nothing else, just to, if you like Risk, if you like Daredevil and sky jumping, get on the Autobahn, get nudged from behind at 80. And we spent the day in Augsburg, and I had only a German guidebook, and she hadn't been there. And I read German, but I don't scan German, so it was about 80 pages, and I was real busy looking away. And we looked all over. We were going to find where this happened. And by evening, we found beautiful things, St. Anne's Church, where Luther stayed. Oh, wonderful stuff. But heading back, we gave up. And finally, I found toward the back, it said, in the Bischofspalast, translated roughly, there is a bronze plaque presented by a party of American evangelicals in 1930 to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the transmission of a Reformation document called the Augsburg Confession. So so I never did see where it all happened.
We didn't either. We couldn't find it. We gave up.
It's a Catholic city. It's a Catholic city. So you can go over there and be dumb. By the way, we'll get back to this in a moment, but Seeing this reminds me, I lost my outline in a moment, and you might have to splice a tape someday if you want it. Way back early this morning, I said Jesus says two things about the future. One, the gates of death will not prevail against church. I forgot the other half. He also asks, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith in the earth? And to me, these two texts remind us that while these sociological forms aren't the whole thing that he means when he says the gates of death shall not prevail against the church, he also leaves with us the sense of risk. It isn't a simply finished product. We are to be co-creators of that. That is only spoken to you, Mr. Sony, so that it'll be on the tape.
Well, we'll listen to that next winter and get another laugh out of it. That's great. No, but the world is yours, and Paul puts this bluntly in front of us. The scriptures are always up to date. All things are yours. You are Christ. Christ is God. My mother is very much a pietistic kind of woman. When I finished the seminary, she said, well, you'll be going to Europe next year and studying, I suppose. And I said, what did you just say? On what? She said, same thing you're going through college on. Well, it's one thing, you can get jobs around America while going through college, and if you get too hard up, you can always make a loan. I had a few of those, too. But she said, oh, if your father lived, he wants you to study in Europe. So she said, I think your heavenly father wants you to. Well, you know, if you're brought up in this kind of an atmosphere, you kind of accept that that's the way maybe the world's run, too. And there are even folk proverbs that says fortune favors the brave. So I said, okay, if you want me to go to Europe next year, I'm willing. I'm not that eager, but I'm willing. And I had $7. My cousin Mark came into the seminary and borrowed it that very day. So there it went, you know, so I could start off from scratch. But sure, we had a great year in Europe. Mary and I had a terrific time. Went over about 3-4 weeks later. Cousin wrote that I thought it was a family legend. He says, your grandfather put me through school so I could be captain. He says, no, I'm Commodore of this fleet. He says, who wants to go with me to Europe? Well, I wrote quick on that one, you know. And so we start off on the West Coast, went down through the Panama Canal, got over in the Azores, and finally ended up with the war on in Ireland instead of over on the Channel ports where we intended to go. But the world was ours, and it is yours. And this is just what Scripture says, and there's nothing strange or foreign to you in it. It belongs to you. My father-in-law, the last time he ordained a bunch of guys to chaplaincy, I said, summed up the whole spirit of the old ELC. And why we didn't always get along so well with the whole spirit of the old Missouri Synod, because he didn't get his Bible quite right. He was ordaining these fellows and been a long service, and finally gets to the end, and a cozy guy, a lot like our Bainton, and he said, now, man, you're going to have a great chaplaincy, and you're going to be effective if you'll just not forget this word of Scripture. This word of St. Paul, he started off. This word of St. Paul. No, not St. Paul, but it's in the Scripture. No, it's not in the Scripture, but it's a good word. Nothing human is foreign to me. Well, nothing human is foreign to me is I think, what the Incarnation says. It's the word, really. And that's what the village is trying to tell you. It's all yours. Gee, we've got science rolling all over the place here. We've got art coming alive for you. How can you go back? And I was thinking last night, we didn't bring up in these values of our time. I didn't catch, at least. But for me, they're tremendous. A public library, the public museum, the public concert, and just the gaiety of getting together with your neighborhood in some kinds of debates at times that you can give and take and end up better friends for having had a little boiling over. And I think also public sauna, we got to get that in too. Well, but I think the church owes the society the fact that it knows the rest of the Lord and how to relax. So we've got to teach the world we live in how to relax and enjoy itself again, even as physical creatures. I think we owe it to this community in which we are guests, that if, since we've got the secret, we better teach them. But this is part, to me, of this kind of a capturing the 20th century moment in the pilgrimage of God's people. So we can sing in the songs of our pilgrimage, in the tents of our pilgrimage, the songs of the Lord that are the tunes of our time and that set these people dancing with us in our dance to the Lord. And to me, this is Holden Village, and that's what I hope you capture when you go home. So you're living in history, not a daydream. Or in the fear, really, that's been produced by a nightmare, that if this goes, God goes with it. He hasn't left us yet, and we won't be able to get away from him, because he is.
Well, we can discuss.
What about the underground church that's beginning to show forth in subtle forms? Because many of us, in some ways, are beginning to reject the established forms of church worship and are seeking more meaningful ways to relate to the church on an individual level, because it's become so overgrown with ecclesiastical trappings that the real personal relevance has somehow been submerged.
Okay, he mentioned this last night. I forgot to get into it this morning. It would be a natural outgrowth of what I was saying by the datability of or obsolescence of some of the forms we now have. And someone was standing nearby wasn't familiar with the term, so let me take just a moment to say what people usually mean by it. The underground church is a term that grew up in the Catholic Church after Vatican II, but is a Catholic and Protestant reality. It is an attempt to find new forms by which people can be apostles. The Lutheran Church has great numbers of such forms. A year ago, Summer Time Magazine was going to do a cover story on the underground church, and they came by and wanted to know if I knew any non-Catholics who were in it, and the phone rang, and a member of the underground church was calling about something, and I turned it over to the Time reporter. She got so carried away by it that the cover was virtually ready to be a Lutheran cover story of these people in the city. And then along came old Pope Paul with Humanae Vitae, and he had to make the cover on birth control, and that knocked us out. But through this, I've been trying to keep in touch with the people who are part of it in our churches. It says if parish, denomination, Sunday school, etc., are not quite appropriate for all the needs of today, how do we go about changing them? I take a dual attitude toward the underground church. Recently, U.S. News and World Report carried an article on it, and for them, I tried to separate two views of it. One side of the underground church, to me, looks like a set of people who are trying to work their way out of the church but need a little liturgy to do it. an awful lot of priests and nuns and others who are on the way out did this. And I remember the second last issue of the Saturday Evening Post had a nice article of Mike Novak on the underground church. What it was about was how numbers of, sort of breathless, number of executives meet every Thursday on the 18th floor of a hotel in Philadelphia, and a priest smuggles some bread and wine up there, and they have an illicit form of the sacrament, illicit, the way the early Christians did it. Real breathless about all this secret stuff that has to go on in order to survive. Well, come back in a year and find out how many of them are going to be around at all, if they're that hung up about it. But there's another side of the underground church, and that is people who are either making their way into the church or laterally around in the church, and for whom then the liturgy and so on is a kind of a natural expression of their way of life. Now, we desperately need such things. We're not content. None of us are content with these forms. I don't think it's controversial to say the things I said earlier this morning, that these forms are all in trouble. We know it. We've been trying desperately. Our whole leadership, all our denominations, are very busy coming out with attempts to form new ways. They do anything to get them going. So far, they haven't been successful. Most of what are called emerging structures of ministry haven't made it. We have wonderful little experiments, Parish Field and East Harlem Protestant Parish and the Church of Our Savior in Washington, and experiment after experiment, but they don't get widespread, and so they're nice parables to inspire us where we are. So far, we haven't had enough of a cultural upheaval to come up with really new forms, and in that sense, I'm a conservative over against some in the underground church. I think until you come up with an alternate, you have to keep something of the old going. Peter Berger some years ago was very critical of a book I'd written because he said the parish just has no potential at all as being a bearer of Christian values. Or if you join a parish, you should at least think of it as being as dangerous a move as entering a monastery. It shouldn't be an automatic expression of Christian life. Well, I share his criticisms of the parish, but not much came of the alternatives yet. Now, the underground church, I think, is at its most vital when it's a collection of people located in such a way that the conventional forms just can't do much for them. Just an illustration or two would suffice. The other day I was talking about my friend Roy Bloomhorst and what he learned in Marina City in the apartments while he lived there. One evening they got to talking about what the parish looked like to them. Now these are mainly single people, young adults, or retired people, all of whom have one thing in common. They were brought up in some church or other, but they don't go now. I mentioned that the church wanted to start a Sunday school in those 1,100 apartments, and there were 16 children, all Jewish. One Sunday morning, he and his wife stood at the base of the two towers and watched people from 6 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon and tried to see who looked as if it's just possible they might be heading for a church, reasonably dressed and so on. And it came into less than a dozen. Now, they'll talk to one after another of these. He talked to one guy who'd say, sorry, but I'm from a small town. I'm Lutheran. I believe it all, but I'm a homosexual. They wouldn't accept me, and there isn't a parish in town where if they know about me, they'd accept me. I'm not going to go to church. All right, he had to build up a different way of ministering to this kind of man. And in that kind of gathering, one day they get to talking about what the parish then did mean to them. How can you be Christian and not part of it? One of them said, well, every parish I've seen looks very much like this. He said, I work for Montgomery Ward. And a parish looks a lot like that to me. Suppose we, all the employees and the service personnel, went inside Montgomery Ward, and then at 9 in the morning, they locked the door, and they sold things to each other, and they fed each other, and they did acts of service to each other, and that's it. Well, I look at my parish bulletin, and we can go 6 months, and there's not an activity there that tells us that we're in a world beyond the parish. We sell tickets to each other for events we don't want to go to. We perform services for each other. Now, again, it's wonderful to have a cell of people who are responsible to each other, but that's only half of what a parish ought to be for. The other half ought to be out there. So the underground people come along and say, there's one on the west side of Chicago now, Jack London, LCA, I forget what it's called now. They meet in a barn, and they have church every Sunday. They're very conventional that way. One Eucharist, one prayer style, one, there were 4 different styles each month. And they will never collect a penny for their local church. They will never build. If they ever want to get to the stage of wanting a hymn book, a member will just have to buy that and bring it along. More likely they'll just mimeograph things, and their hymn book looks a lot more like our song sheet up in the dining hall. Any money they ever collect will have to leave. It'll have to go for something else. Now, that's not going to work for everybody. If you go to Jack London's place, you'll find that, in general, this is attractive to, this is in Oakbrook, which is our plushest new suburb, though it draws from 20 miles around from some very non-plush suburbs. But these are people who are, in general, college graduates. They have a little control of their own schedule. They can pick up and go. They are cosmopolitan and metropolitan types. I don't think you could pull it off in the area of northwest side of Chicago, where I've had some ministry among 8-hour-a-day people who are not free to pick up and go as easily. So his form just can't be the form. It has to go everywhere. But it's very much appropriate for that set of people to give a whole new spiritual charge and to remind all of us as we think about them, are we doing some of that in our own places? So, just as I see 2 underground churches, one, a group of people who wish they didn't have anything left of church, but they were brought up in it and they got to get out of it. Don't worry about them, they aren't around long. And the other, who are moving around in it and making the rest of us a little jumpy and giving us new ideas. Now, for them, again, there are 2 ways to do it. You can be an underground church as an elite, and that's death. That is, we happy few who finally found each other. You start talking to each other in the same terms, and well, that's it. So I always say they have to relate themselves somehow to what I call the great big messy church. Their mission field might very well be the great big messy church. A group of people on the west side of Chicago got together recently and asked our assistant pastor whether he would be minister at large to the metropolis. They'd raise $200,000 and he could live off the interest. These were Catholics, Protestants, etc. And then he said, well, will you all keep going to your home parishes too? About half of them said yes, they would. The other half said, no, you minister to us. Just then came a call to Berkeley, and since he is a glutton for punishment, he took that and will be our new campus pastor at Berkeley. But here was a good case again where you could see. He could see that for some of them this meant their being involved in a ministry to Chicago. For others, it meant helping foot the bill so that somebody who would run a little liturgy of the kind they liked would satisfy them and give them some spiritual kicks. So there are really so many things under the category underground church. The above-ground church is far more nervous about underground than it ever need be, that I have to say. Our church body is, there are people who just get hysterical when they learn that there are people that have communion in somebody's home and so on. Well, I look out at today's 23-year-old in the city. Well, good sample. A year ago Thanksgiving, Elsa and I invited about 40 of these people out to our home, and we had a communion in the form of the didache from the early church, and then we went downstairs and she served a spaghetti supper to them, and then they collected the offering, $65, for paint, because they were going to paint ghetto apartments the next day. I've been with this group on a day a girl in it had been raped. I've been with this group at a time when a boy in it couldn't come because he was pinned to a floor in Cabrini Apartments protecting a girl in the group because they were getting sniped at, and it lasted 2 days. They never would have made that party. It feels like the early Christians. If I say, you kids got to trudge off to Old Grace Church on Lakeshore, they aren't going to do it. They aren't going to minister to it, and it isn't going to minister to them. Thanksgiving Day, they bummed church. They were painting apartments. They had the church the night before. Now, some people get very nervous about this. Who kept the record as a communion card? Most Lutheran groups have that annual thing that 12,483 people communed that year, or if they're good Lutherans, 283 communed. You always get the message, don't commune too often. Who keeps track of the records to see how few did? All right, suppose our computers get a little loused up and we miss by a couple hundred thousand some year. 100 years from now, might the kingdom know? But the kingdom was operative that next day. People are very nervous about this. Now, a lot of these people will, in a few years, marry. Last Sunday, we ran into one of them up here, Bill Karpenko. How many of you know Bill Karpenko? You meet him, Bill and Michelle? He's getting his master's in psychology, wants to go for a doctorate in psychology, but when we met him, he was driving a cab. Took 2 years out because he thought college was not teaching him people, and if he wants to know psychology, the best way to be is a cab driver. Well, Bill was, Time Magazine was ready to run him as a real feature here. Here was the lost soul of today. Here he is with a little knockout called Michelle, and I thought, well, in 2 years there'll be one, and in 4 years there'll be two, and he'll find his own little home in the suburbs, and he'll be as seedy and corrupt and dull as all the rest of us, and he'll go to a regular old church, and he'll be a good member in it. And a better one for these years when he was this way. So the underground church can't be the normative pattern. You've got to be Bill Karpenko, free to take 2 years off to drive a cab. You've got to be able to... another girl in that group, it was a nurse from Canada, and she couldn't get her visa or immigration papers quite in order somehow. And so the group paid her to do free nursing. Violates all the patterns you do these things. Well, this is what the church must have been like in the early church. So when it's a cult of like-minded people that like each other too much, forget it. But if they see some mission to the whole church and through it to the whole society, I think it's a beautiful thing.
What do you think of these movements that are developing in some big cities where Christians who aren't satisfied with their church of any very denomination get together in small groups and studying the scriptures and everything without a minister? Mm-hmm. They still keep contributing to the crew. They go around doing good works, not in the helping people in trouble, not in the Joe Comforter kind of way, trying to get them loans and see if they get medical attention, that kind of thing. And they help each other interpret the scriptures, and they say they do a better job than a minister could possibly do, because in the standard Sunday service, you see the minister, and he talks for 15 minutes or so, and then you have any leave, and you never see him again for another week, so these people do it. Learning a lot more about the scriptures than they ever did before, and they're also accomplishing great things in a practical Christian way, and they set some kind of a limit for the size of the group, and when the group exceeds this size, they split off and start another one. The only disadvantage is to it, since they don't have any formal organization, they can't deduct from their income tax, but they still they're going to get quite rapidly. I heard Bishop Pike say that in Oklahoma, there's some parish there where the whole congregation voluntarily sold their church building and fired their minister and broke into small groups and kept on this fissioning process. And now the membership of, the total membership of the group now has doubled or tripled over what it was originally when it was a formal church.
And the San Antonio group has done this. Well, this is another form of the underground church. I think if you use some these and thous, it would have sounded to us very much like the third, fourth, and fifth chapter of the book of Acts you just read us. This is what it must have been like. And if there's any caste of people in our society that, by and large, doesn't have to worry about it, it's ministers. Because, for one thing, that's what they conceive their task to be, equipping the saints for the work of ministry. Oh, just think how a preacher ought to feel if he knows that people are off somewhere studying Bible and so on. Secondly, it's going to happen to so few people that they're not going to run out of jobs. There's enough ministerial shortage that they don't even have to be insecure about it. Third, if they were in the home parish, they wouldn't be studying the Bible, at least if they're Lutherans. We're about the lowest in any denomination on studying the Bible. We're about 0.0003% of our adults go to Sunday school, Bible class. So they wouldn't be doing it if they were at a regular church, and they are doing it where they are. Now, again, they may come off with some funny stuff and all, but they might have some funny stuff if they were in a regular parish, too. So it's going to be so exceptional that I don't think we have to see any reason to worry about it. I think in almost every such case, again, like these people at their communion in our home that night, I keep thinking, I'm just so glad that they want communion. It's such an act of affirmation and response on its own that I just couldn't bring it in me somehow to say do it only a certain way.
Marty,
yes.
I wonder if you could, you and Carol both could comment on another form of church that's developing and apparently get a lot of folks and make a lot of money. churches that sprang up as a result of education at Bob Jones University. Churches that are developing as a result of Ben Billy Hargis and a few others who seem to be gathering, I guess, what we call momentum, and probably second in growth only to the Mormon Church, you know, to mm-hmm. today, who's leading the whole pack for obvious reasons.
Well, yeah, they're churches in the sociological sense, I guess. Certainly this is present, and it's part of the malaise of our times. Things like this happen in the mainline Protestant churches all the time, too, and there are congregations that look just like that and exist just for that. In other words, you're talking about the spiritual version of backlash.
Right.
Now, this is not a surprise, because I think in any society, people do tend to take religious symbols and apply them to what they feel very deeply about. And here people feel very deeply about atheistic communism or socialistic trends in our society, etc., etc., and you want to be sure that God is on your side for it. There are a lot of good, sincere people caught up in it. There are a lot of dropouts caught up in it. There are a lot of people who have a case against the world caught up in it. I think it's an ominous sign. It's not the only ominous sign on our horizon, but it's the spiritual version of it. I don't ever know whether to be apocalyptic or not. I don't know how much to talk about Armageddon and so on. But on the short-range future for America, I have great concern, not that we turn explicitly fascist, but I think in very subtle ways, we won't quite realize it, that we give up freedom after freedom and freedom after freedom. And I think if we do that as a whole, we will do this not in a secular way, but in a very religious way. We'll be sure that it's what God had in mind for us all the time. I don't want to over-maximize it. I listen to my car radio every morning as I go to the university to Carl McIntyre. And listening to him from one point of view, I get the shivers because I know there are so and so many 100,000 people that support it, and he rakes in $19 million a year and all that, and you know, I really worry about it. And in some places it can be devastating. On the other hand, I also know how frail it all is. I know that it's kind of a paper empire, etc. So I'm worried enough about it. But in the terms Hertzfeld and I were talking about last night, our basic approach to these things in church life is exorcism, throwing out demons. And my short liturgical formulation for exorcism is only one word. It's boo! when these people come along to me and say, don't do that or don't be that or how can you, you turn around and say, boo! And Billy James is a little too heavy for me to make go away that way. But a lot of people find that if they can't enthrall you, throw you into thraldom, that word is going to stick. Before. They can't have you tethered to their view of things. They stop bothering you, and you help liberate some other people, keep them out of their grasp. I think what we have to do is to be sure that we help create the kind of culture and church that keeps people from having the problems that make these things attractive to them. That's what we really have to work on hard.
And a few stimulators to each area will do it. I mean, you don't have to have many. I mean, this is one of the things that thrills me about the village. The average person comes here, travels over 2,000 miles to get here, and you're scattered all over our churches. But it only takes one or two to make the rest of them intimidated. See, our kids said at Missoula in 57, no church has a right to the name Christian, which makes a difference on the basis of color. And I got letters from Louisiana, Alabama, all over the country. They're scared about something some kids say up in Missoula, Montana. You know, well, this is how tender the situation is. All you have to do is open your mouth. Like he says, all you have to do is say boo, one way or another. And suddenly they can't form anymore. They got to do it so covertly that they have a hard time staying together. And their kids will see they don't succeed. Yeah.
Same thing happened. Remember when you had Walter Luther?
That reminds me of a friend in Chicago whose congregation always wanted to preach a Mother's Day sermon, and he was a generally concessionistic type, but one year it hit on Pentecost, and they insisted to be a Mother's Day sermon, and he dropped the third of the great holidays and all that, and it bothered him. So to get it out of their system, he said, boo. He announced that he was going to start a seven-year series on great Lutheran mothers, and the first one was the mother of Walter Luther. Future years, he's going to have the mother of Friedrich Nietzsche and the mother of, you know, all these German god killers in the 19th century were children of the Lutheran parsonage. And he had a real series going. Well, after the first one, they were free, and if he wants to preach Mother's Day now, he can, and if he wants to preach Pentecost, he can. So, okay, some more odd names?
Yes.
Well, we have begun. I think a lot of people have begun. I personally don't have problems with that. I told you that. Athanasian just isn't very meaningful to me. I do think, again, the historical sense, I think the liturgy of the future should incorporate an awful lot of the liturgy of the past to give us the sense of the communion of saints, of, you know, ecumenicity and time and that. But I don't think that we are beginning to touch all the resources from the past that ought to be part of our worship. As I said that night in our little group, we used the didache as our form. We should look up more of these rites instead of just slight revisions of our own. Now, the other night, I thought we're getting this communion together, and these fellows wrote this beautiful service, and they're all ready to go, and then I thought, well, now here comes old preacher Marty. Oh, I was nervous. I got to impose some things on them. You know, where's the Agnus Dei? Where's the Sanctus? Who writes a mass without them? Well, they haven't gotten that far yet, or didn't do it. And I thought, well, maybe they sang something like the Sanctus among the hymns that night, across the Brook Kidron or something. But I can't picture that Passover meal, if it was that, or that Last Supper, which it was, followed that particular order. So we know how random and haphazard those things got put together. Dr. Baton told us how Luther revised the liturgy. He wanted to make it shorter. Threw out all kinds of things so he could preach longer. Today we'd like to preach a little shorter and have a little more time in the liturgy again. The pericopes. Yeah, I think that's the problem. We don't often think about it because it's there all the time. And it might be good if some Sunday morning we ask the young adults of our church to write the profession of faith for that day. And then we have to worry about the terms they use and wrestle with it. I think that's it. You have to throw it up to find out what it was. Then you go back to it and you see new meaning in it.
And even this interpretation we give today, you know, mm-hmm. it is a different break down the Greek that gave us that formulation. If we understand that, we begin to say, well, that's kind of a beautiful expression given that sort of situation. But not very many people come back there.
I think an interesting highlight on that is, I'm sure that most of you are going to see it in years to come. It hasn't been completed yet, but over several years, a study has been made of all Lutheran churches in Detroit, and believe it or not, five or six independent Lutheran churches, and the Wisconsin Synod went in on this, and I think it encompasses about 250 churches. Made a study, you know, on what's going on in the churches, and I was privileged to be in a group where we just looked at the man who ran it. It was run with some of the universities that we hired to do it. Took only about 27 questions that were asked people, and one of them was on liturgy, or a series of them. And I recall this much, that 58% of the people in our churches in Detroit said they didn't like the liturgy of the church. 52% said they didn't think we were free to change it. That this is God's will if we worship in the way the liturgy is.
Yeah. I think that's what Joel's getting at. So it's not the problem of the old language. Very often for me, a better liturgy is to go further back instead of further forward. It's just that are we really going to be free to go further back or further over and so on? Recently, a new friend of mine, Monsignor Joseph Raya, Archbishop of Saint Jean d'Acre, Haifa, Nazareth, and all the Galilee. In other words, the lucky guy who gets to be the priest to the people who live where Jesus lived, sent me a new Byzantine missal that he had written. It's the Melkite Rite, that is, they are loosely responsible to Rome, but quite free to do things the Greek way. So they're more orthodox than Roman, but they don't sever with Rome. Well, I put that next to my bedside, and I started the first few days, and I thought, well, this is a strange language for me, far from what we usually do. And then you get onto it. This is the part of the church that's really talked resurrection all the centuries. How much of the language of the Orthodox has really been taken over in the West? No, there's no reason it isn't. They're nurturing some things that we might very well need now. Why not make that a part of what we do some days? I don't think this will cause people to be less interested in Christian history, but rather more so. They're going to get a little more curious as to why we are doing this form this day.
I think our new liturgical book is going to have enough different varieties so nobody can hang you with this past thing, too. But what knocked us out was the willingness of the Swedes to be complacent with the rest of the church. I think the Swedes have hurt all of us in America by not being more stubborn like us Norwegians. If they'd stayed to their church order, we would have still had aspects of that. Boy, they start out, holy, holy, holy. That's the first note you heard when the old church was starting. Your backbone was about melting to water about that time, you know. And the Lord is in his holy temple, and you were with it. You know, you weren't groveling. You were exalting as a church. So why they allowed the rest of us to push us around, I never
understood. Some days you have to change the context. That is, it's much harder to revise a hymnal than to revise worship. If you come in with messy mimeographing like we had the other night, you can do anything with it. But if you have a committee that has to work on a hymnal, you can't do much with it. I know a church body that nearly split because they changed the "Blessed be the tie that binds" line from "When we asunder part, it gives us inward pain" to something else. Now, as a little boy, I used to sing that hymn, and I pictured somebody on a rack, you know, "When we asunder part." try to change a line like that, and you got a real fight. It's hard to change a hymnal. So the hymnal should be a nice little book among all the other books that we use to put worship together. And this is a trend. I don't think you have to fight for this. This is coming.
A relationship between the hymns that have been used in history and the way the gospel is proclaimed. I'm thinking especially of some of the kids that the Lutherans usually do not identify with. And it seems to me that the kind of fervor that is proclaimed in a tent meeting produces a certain kind of artistic manifestation Is there a cultural correlation?
Oh, yes, there's a very strong cultural correlation there. And here's, again, the reason we like a larger spectrum of things. When Missouri Synod wanted to put out a supplement to a hymnal, they wrote me a letter saying, "You used to be a poet." That's how I got my start. And you're interested in social action. Would you write a song about the modern city and so on? Well, I made several hundred embarrassing attempts. And I kept thinking all the time how poorly I was doing this. I remembered I was attending a church in St. Louis that in the 30s had a very forward-looking minister and decided he was going to have a modern, relevant set of windows. And so he had Amo Fry Studios design them, and it had an airplane and so on. Well, it's a little biplane flitting through that little church window. And in some ways, it's more out of date than if you had a plow or something like that. That is, a certain way the symbols date very quickly. And so, in a sense, what I wanted to say in that hymn couldn't be said, because while it might have been a honey for next Sunday, it'd be out of date 2 years from now. Certain symbols quickly change. What I should have learned is the kind of thing that brokering knows. You use different formats when you want to do these things. You don't worry about whether they're going to be around. But when you start thinking of an 800-page red book and you're going to be in it for 40 years, I worried about being the biplane man. Or have you been to Muhlenberg? Yeah. Wait a minute. What's Allentown? Not Muhlenberg. Gettysburg. At Gettysburg. Have you been in that college chapel?
Yep.
Okay. There you got a huge mosaic or mural of Jesus and a college graduate. Now, the people who did that with all good intention wanted to show that Jesus is relevant to the college graduate and all that. That is low camp 10 years later, because the guy has a haircut the way they don't have haircuts now. He has a tie the way they don't have ties now. Even academic robes have changed in 10 years. And they'd have done much better with a Byzantine icon or something. When you start getting muraled that much, you better not tie yourself down too much. But on the other hand, gradually we are evolving a 20th century language of hymnody, and you know this better than I. Someday people will be able to look back on it and say, this really could only have been born in that time. Now, the kitsch that you're talking about, generally the hymns that were formed out of the Victorian era of piety, if there were objective standards, I would say probably the lowest in Christian history, got wrapped in. Now, there's some tremendous hymns that were born just before that, in the era of Charles Wesley and so on. They're never going to be out of date. But some of these sludgy old, dreary old things that got in are in real trouble. Well, then, nice to resurrect Oh Gladsome Light, or something that St. Ambrose did, or something Morning attributed Star. To Bernard of Clairvaux, and let somebody do that for the modern world. In other words, I believe that there are certain primal symbols to which men are responsive in any age. Bread. You can talk about that, and it's around. Now, maybe the day will come when we do get our meals chemically, a red pill, a blue pill, and a yellow pill, and we may have to explain to people what bread is. But there are certain things. Hand. There are certain primal symbols to which we respond, and we basically, I think, we were reworking them in the language of our various days.
They'd like to have had a new one some years ago already, though. They tell me, please write an article knocking it. We want to get rid of it so we can make more money putting out a new one. So, you know.
Yeah, but if you or I write the article, that might just help the hymnal live another 20 years. I think hymnals of the future should be loose leaf. You know.
So where's Harv? I think you should have rung a bell. Somebody's yes, on. Where, I don't know. Excuse me.
Well, we have one more here.
Stay around here. Yes. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Carla. Yeah.
We have a lot of words in our liturgy that if you think too much about them, you'd not like to think too much about them. I remember one day when Joe Sittler preached in your hometown of Joliet, where we have the state penitentiary, and the collect for the day was, fling wide the doors of all prisons and release all. If the citizenry of Joliet really listened to that prayer, they wouldn't want to be praying it. They'd be dead by evening. There's a lot of that kind of lingo we're going to have to work over. Well, this is my last bell. I enjoyed being with you this week. I hope our paths will often cross.